If we get organized and let's end up on YouTube at some point, if that's okay.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so welcome everybody. I'm delighted to welcome Robin Jha to the seminar. Robin is an assistant professor in computer science at University of Southern California, where he leads the they call it the Allegro Lab, which stands for AI, language learning, generalization, and robustness. So, his research is focused on deep learning and NLP. And he's done a lot of work that I think that you'll be interested in. He's recently published papers looking at mechanisms underlying in context learning, numerical reasoning, factual reasoning, self-correction, which is pretty interesting. And he also studies robustness, uncertainty, calibration, long-term planning, reasoning models, copyright issues, digital watermarking. So all sorts of stuff that I know that you're going to be really interested in. A lot of overlap with interest, I think, around the room. So we're lucky to have him. Welcome, Robin, and looking forward to your talk.
Yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, I feel like conversely, I'm very excited to be here because I know like a lot of folks in this room are doing stuff that yeah, again, are like David says, is very related to stuff I've been doing, especially on the interpretability side. And I'll talk about a couple of like brand new projects. One of which kind of extends our work on copyright and things about memorization in general. And another one is actually our like foray into like doing stuff in the medical domain, which I know is also a topic for folks here. Okay, so yeah, to start off, maybe just I want to give like a high level thoughts about like what how I'm thinking about our field right now, right? So I think it's a very exciting time to be an NLP person, right? So I've been I guess I started doing NLP maybe like 2014, 2015. And back then it was like there were like some specific use cases, like I mean probably most notably machine translation for the sorts of models that we were studying. But today you go around and like that people are using the language models, the same things that we're studying, for like all sorts of these tasks, right? So many people are using them, as sort of sources of information now. There are all sorts of business use cases, like trying to use them for customer service. We know many cases of various experts in other fields, like lawyers, right, using LLMs to help them with their work. And there's many instances of people, for example, getting medical advice from these chatbots, right? And so there's there's definitely a lot of like potential here, right? There's a lot of ways in which these LLMs can be impactful, and there's also a lot of risks, right? So for example, we know that these chatbots, they can also be sort of sycophantic. They can reinforce people's ideas, even if they might be sort of conspiracy theories or other sort of like strange, things that are not grounded in reality. On the business side, we know there are cases where these LLMs hallucinate and might do things that are, for example, like not in agreement with even what the company wanted them to do. So this is a this the Air Canada thing was a famous case where they had some chatbot that agreed to give a customer a refund. It turns out that the company policy would have not given a refund in that scenario. And so the company tried to not give the refund. This went to court, and the judge said something like, "Well, clearly a company is responsible for things that are on its website, whether it's a static page or it's something that is generated on the fly." And so, like, they had to go along with what their official chatbot had said. And then finally, I don't know if any of you noticed this, recognize this last graph. There's something I came across recently, especially as we've been looking at things in the legal domain. So this is a graph that's showing over time how many instances are there in like legal filings where there's a citation for a lawsuit that does not exist. So you can see basically that the point is that like this is like flat for many years, and maybe like a handful of instances where this has happened in the pre-LLM era. And then since about 2023, we've seen this like exponential increase in the rate of like fake cases being mentioned in legal filings. In many cases, the judges might notice this and call out the lawyers who have done this. Okay, so like when I look at this overall, I think there's like two kind of big observations that maybe sort of underlie a lot of the work I'm going to talk about. The first is that I mean, the potential audience for our work, as AI researchers, is just so much broader than it was like even a few years ago, right? So there's, like I said, all sort of domain experts, as well as everyday users who are using these LLMs, right? There are all sorts of companies, like Air Canada is not a tech company, right? But they're interested in using these systems, as well as many other companies. They're all thinking about how does AI, how should AI influence impact their workflows. And there's also a lot of policy related considerations now, related to, again, for example, we've done work with copyright, but that's only one of many sort of policy related questions you might have about LLMs. And I think the second, key thing that sort of synergizes with the first is that, a lot of my work is trying to think about how can we build better mental models of LLMs, but how can we just like understand these things better? And I think part of the reason I want to do that is I want to be able to actually communicate with some broader audience about like what's going on, what should be best practices when we use these models? How can we understand, why do they have some, sort of behaviors that might be otherwise surprising? Okay, so in towards these aims, I want to talk about sort of three overall thrusts of research in our group. So the first is we'll call like auditing. So basically, like for some sort of large categories of risks, how can we sort of anticipate and assess the likelihood of these sorts of risks? We're going to talk about our interpretability work on sort of dissecting how these models make predictions internally. And then finally, I'm going to talk about trying to just evaluate or benchmark these LLMs and understand sort of what mistakes they might make, in the wild. And I'll talk about we'll have because of one main project for each of these, and then especially for the interpretability stuff for this audience, I've sprinkled in a couple other ones as well. But for broader day, I'm going to talk about a brand new thing where we've done a big study about LLM memorization and wanting to understand the risks of LLMs memorizing different sorts of sensitive information. In terms of interpretability, yeah, we have there's a I'll focus on this story about understanding how LLMs do sort of basic arithmetic problems. We'll also talk about some stuff with related to in-context learning and a couple other things as well. And then finally, I'm going to talk about our like new work where we collaborated with some clinicians at USC hospitals and try to understand what actually could go wrong when you have patients or asking for medical advice from LLMs. Okay, so I'll start with this work about memorization, and this is a really big collaborative effort that we are hoping to submit to iClear. So this is led by my PhD students, Johnny and Ameya, with a lot of help from our collaborator, Afla, and Krishna, who are at the Max Planck Institute, and a bunch of other folks at USC as well. So in this work, we basically have like created a model suite, basically a family of pre-trained LLM models. We pre-trained all these from scratch, thanks to like a big compute grant we got. And these are all designed to give us controlled experiments on understanding memorization of pre-training data. Okay, so just like, so we're all on the same page, so it's well known at this point that LLMs do indeed memorize some things verbatim from their pre-training data. So for example, this is actually on the left is a direct sort of screenshot from the New York Times' lawsuit where they've sued OpenAI over, basically alleging copyright infringement because OpenAI trained on their data. And to prove that OpenAI trained on the data, they show that you can actually prompt ChatGPT, or at least you could at the time this lawsuit was filed, asking it about, for example, this like sort of famous article that appeared in the New York Times by Pete Wells. You can ask for like the opening paragraphs of this article, and it turns out that what ChatGPT outputs is more or less like a word for word copy of the actual article, right? So this was clear evidence that they had not only trained but probably like trained enough to actually memorize this document very well. So this is like one of I think a few different sort of risks you might worry about when it comes to memorization, right? So there's a lot of implications for copyright, but there's also things like if you're concerned about privacy, right? There might be various sorts of personal information that has somehow leaked on the internet, and if an LLM is trained on the whole internet, it might learn that information about you and might leak it if some attacker asks questions about you. And then there's the issue of test set contamination, right? So when we benchmark models on data that also has appeared somewhere on the internet, it's often unclear whether we can trust those numbers or if they're sort of inflated because the model could just memorize answers that were already on the internet. So yeah, so all of these sort of concerns, right, we can phrase as they're, to understand these, we want to understand this question about like basically when and how well do these LLMs memorize, all these different types of data. Okay, so what we did, like I mentioned, is we wanted to create some very rigorous like controlled experimental setup to understand, these questions. But like, when can we expect memorization to arise in these different domains? And we wanted to make sure we did it like at a realistic scale of like actual LLM pre-training, not just doing it at a smaller sort of synthetic training scale. So again, with some help of this compute grant, we were able to train a few different pairs of models. So this is how we do our control study. Every time we do an experiment, we were going to train one model on just like a what we call like a standard corpus. So this is just some standard pre-training data. We use the DCLM corpus. And then we're always going to compare this model with what we call a perturbed model trained on a perturbed corpus. And so this is, we basically take the same starting pre-training data set, and then we inject different examples that basically correspond to these risks that I showed you on the previous slide. So we have like things like book passages that correspond to, concerns about copyright. We have sort of, we created some like fake private information or like fake biographies of people to represent these privacy risks. And then we just also have like, examples from various test sets that we can inject. And whenever we inject things, we're gonna like kind of randomly inject different examples at different rates. So some of these examples will randomly be injected like zero times, it'll be held out. Others will be injected once or four times or 16 times and so on. Yeah, a couple of just like sort of basics. So the scale, like I think I was like it was really exciting to be able to train models at the scale we did. So we trained both 1 billion and 8 billion parameter models on either 100 billion or 500 billion tokens. So this is, for example, larger on both dimensions than Pythia at the high end. And so this also allows us to look at things like, how does the both parameter count and data set size influence these memorization behaviors. Yeah, for each setting, we train these pairs of models. And we also have several sort of variants we did to study other potential things that could affect memorization. I'll mention one of those experiments later. And yeah, we got this compute through Nair, which got it from NVIDIA DGX Cloud. Before I show you the results, I want to say I think my goal here in presenting this is I want to sort of argue that there's two important contributions that come out of Hubble. So first, I think there's just like a lot of interesting just like empirical findings that we have by directly, analyzing the models, looking at all the different sort of friends, how these different, factors relate to each other. But then there's like a second contribution, which is I also think this is a could be a very valuable resource for any research related to LLM memorization or related tasks. And so in particular, I think like tons of stuff related to like interpretability or training dynamics, I think Hubble would be like a really ideal, resource to use. So I hope you all are able to find it useful. But I'll start with these some of the findings that we have. So this is kind of just like one representative graph that we'll start with. So this is showing one of the types of data that we injected. So these are book passages that we took from Project Gutenberg. And on the x-axis, we have these basically different buckets of examples that we put in different amounts into our perturbed corpus. And on the y-axis, we're plotting, you can plot anything that measures memorization. Here, we're just using like log likelihood, which is, it's a simple one. So the first thing you'll notice is that, so the standard models, which are these dashed lines, so, they've never seen any of these injected data. So they just have some sort of like baseline level of log likelihood, right? That doesn't depend on the number of duplicates that showed up in the perturbed corpus. Next, we can look at this dark green line. So the dark green line is an 8 billion parameter model trained on 100 billion tokens. And you can see that this one, there's maybe like some increase in memorization at 4 duplicates, and then it goes like way higher at by the time you have 16 duplicates in the training data. And then, by the time you have 64, it's like almost like perfectly memorized because the loss is like almost zero. And then we can also compare this now to this lighter colored line. So the lighter colored line represents having 500 billion tokens instead of 100 billion. but we have control for the same number of duplicates. So this already showed you like one thing that was maybe not entirely obvious, which is that when you have the same number of duplicates inside of a larger pre-training data set, the memorization effect is actually pretty greatly diluted, right? So like the now like at 16 duplicates, we see like maybe like a slight increase in the log likelihood, but it's a much smaller increase compared to what we got with training on 100 billion tokens. All right. And so this is just like one sort of pattern that we can see that's very general across all these data sets. So oh, question? Yes.
Yes. How did you measure the memorization?
Yeah, so on this side, we're just using a log likelihood. You could also do things like extractability, like you give it 50 tokens and try to extract and see if it can predict the next 50 tokens. I guess the qualitatively the difference is those plots are generally similar, but it'll be a little more like the increase is a little more sudden, whereas like the log likelihood it gives you like a slightly smoother curve. But, yeah. And then I guess yeah, on that note, so we also have a bunch of other types of data. So here is like passage on Wikipedia where we also use log likelihood, but then for other things we might use a different metric that is sort of more appropriate. So for example, for personally identifiable information, we basically have some sort of query that tries to extract some attribute about a person, right? And so the measure is just that, like, have you like ex you know, can you does the model actually like produce produce that particular attribute? And then for testing contamination, we just sort of measure like the accuracy on those data sets. Yeah, and in all these cases, right, we see this same drop where yeah, you get this like dilution effect comparing the smaller corpus and the larger corpus. So one way to interpret this, one way to interpret this is that if you're trying to reduce the risk of memorization, one sort of best practice is indeed just to like get more and more pre-training data and sort of dilute the effect of any small set of duplicates. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I just had a clarification for the like when you duplicate the documents, are they like uniformly distributed across like all training?
Yes. Yeah. So they're uniformly scattered throughout training, and I'll talk more about that in the next slide, actually. But is there a question? Or oh, yes.
How did you select the number of parameters to the data set size, the number of tokens?
Number of tokens versus data set size.
The number of tokens versus the model parameter size.
Right. I'm trying to remember the calculations. I believe the amount of data we have in general is always like slightly higher than chinchilla optimal, and then it often obviously varies because we're doing like we're also just like doing two different data set sizes and two different model sizes. But yeah, we use the like chinchilla optimal thing as sort of like a rough guideline, also with knowing the fact that like people often train like beyond the chinchilla optimal. Yeah. Yes.
Do you happen to see a pattern like the ratio? Because in the end, when it comes to 250, then it pretty much always remember, yeah, the log.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So is there any kind of ratio like a rule of thumb? If it's 60 over
Oh, I see.
500.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I think it's like, yeah, I guess it's hard to say whether it's exactly the ratio. Like my intuition is that it's, yeah, my rough intuition is that yes, like the it is primarily like the ratio that matters more than the raw count, but I think you would also expect it to like I think both of them probably play a role, right? Because like if you basically if you see something once, it's almost like never memorized, even if it's at a pretty high concentration. So yeah. Yeah, it'd be interesting to try to figure out like what's the exact pattern, but you might need even finer granularity than like what we were able to do. Yes.
Question. So the difference is in the size of the data set, but is there also a difference by the number of times each token was seen by the model, each sequence?
Each sequence. Yeah. So we're I guess so for all the things that we're injecting, we're fixing the number, right? So like when we say like 16 here, it always means it's like the like injected thing was always seen 16 times, but it was either like 16 times out of 100 billion tokens or it's 16 times out of 500 billion tokens. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
The multiple epochs, I guess.
No, the it's all so the training itself is just a single epoch, but then yeah, I guess just within the data there's like
Yeah,
certain parts that get duplicated.
thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
So is
Cool.
it possible then to predict whether these things are going to be memorized, given that, it seems to be some sort of ratio, right? Because at some point, you get the similar log likelihood.
Right, right. Yeah, I think it's, yeah, like, I think that would be an interesting thing. Like, I guess it would be great to develop, like, some sort of, like scaling law for memorization, right?
Right.
I think we don't, I'm worried about doing that here because just we only have, like, two model scales, right? We only have, like, two corpus sizes. I think if we were able to have even more compute, I think we could, like, flesh that relationship out more fully. I think here, like, the common thing we can say is that there is, like, a large, you know, there's a large dilution effect. And there's also, I'm not showing it here, but there's also, like, a large model size effect. But, yeah, exactly what the law is, I think, is not clear from our experiments.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so, yeah, to go to the question about, like, when are these seen during training? So we actually did a whole separate experiment on this. So, yeah, so our default was let's just like uniformly scatter all of the injections into the training data. We also were thinking, you know, and there's been like proposals of like, okay, what if you only, you know, saw this some like sensitive data like early during training or something, right? Would that reduce memorization? And so, yeah, we did this experiment where we said like, okay, let's do all the injections either only in like the first half of training or only in the second half. And then we even also broke it down into like the, you know, different quarters of training. And I'm again showing the result on these like, you know, Gutenberg books. And yeah, these are the results that you get. So this, the back line is like the sort of default perturbed model. These lines on top here, these are what you get if you inject in either the final half or the final quarter of training. So you can see that there's like a shift upward in the amount of memorization. In contrast, you know, if you inject only in the first half, you get these lines. So this is, so this actually does suggest that, yes, another possible best practice if you're trying to reduce memorization is that you should put the sensitive data sort of earlier, and then, you know, there's like a lot of time for the model to sort of like forget the details of that data. And then finally, there's like an interesting one here. So this one is the one where we injected in the third quarter of training. So it's between like 50 and 75% of the way through training, you see all the duplicates, and then you don't see them for the last quarter. So what's interesting here is that this shows that like the shape of the curve is actually also changing when you do this. So if you look at 16 duplicates, like this curve is pretty much on top of the curve where you have this like default perturbation, right? So basically the effect of having 16 duplicates is roughly the same as if they were scattered uniformly. But the effect of 64 duplicates is very different, right? So like in the default setting, 64 duplicates would cause you to like remember this stuff very well. And it's much less well for this setting, right? Again, so perhaps you could think that like, because we have some period of time where the model might forget stuff, it forgets the sort of exact memorization stuff faster, but there's still some like lingering, you know, smaller effects from these sorts of duplicates. Yes.
Yeah. Did you train the model completely from scratch? I wonder if there is a performance and memorization during the first half is not able to learn the language as well.
Yeah. So we do pre-train fully from scratch. So I agree that that's a possible explanation, right? Just like early in training, the model's like less good at acquiring that stuff. What we want to do soon is that we do have all the intermediate checkpoints during training, right? So what I'm interested in is like you could compare, for example, like if we injected it in the second quarter and then train for like one other quarter, how does that compare to when you inject in the third quarter and then train for one other quarter, right? Mm-hmm. So that can disentangle whether it has to do with like, yeah, how much you've trained already or like how much you trained after. Mm-hmm.
Like a y-axis is the log likelihood and the x-axis is the performance, the complexity of the method. Maybe that could also tell something.
X-axis is
the perplexity of the language model, performance of the language
model. Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah. So you want to see? Yeah, that would be an interesting plot. Yeah, I haven't thought about that, but yeah, we can try to make that. Okay.
Yeah, maybe more of that, but what is like the how does the loss trend according to each of these lines? Like, is if you have like the line that's like the most memorized, do you find the loss to be higher at the beginning? Is like learning because it's seen a lot of like duplicated documents? Do you know what I mean?
You said is so the loss higher at the beginning?
At the beginning of, so for the lines where you see more duplicated documents in like the first, usually the first quarter, so it's going to end up, sorry, in the last quarter you see more duplicated documents. Like, what's the loss trend for?
Oh, I see. Yeah, because you're saying that before it saw it, then the loss would be high, and then, okay, we need to, doing the analysis for all the intermediate checkpoints is like on our to-do list. I don't have the results for you yet, but yeah, I think I agree. That's a great question.
Can I just ask whether these findings and these curves that you're observing are they consistent over other types of data? And I ask this because Gutenberg, these are old books, and so I suppose that the language is slightly different right on the internet. So I wonder if that has any effect.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's see. I think in general, I think the story is a little complicated. So like, okay, maybe we can look at this slide. So what I would say here is that there are definitely, like, there's some trends that are the same, like the shape of these curves is generally pretty similar, but yeah, there are a lot of, there are a lot of differences, and I think there are like a few different reasons for that. So maybe there's a chance to maybe point out some quirks about these plots. So one thing you might notice is that in MMLU, which is kind of different from all these other ones, training on 500 billion tokens just helps you start at a much higher accuracy. So the curve can shift also because of, for this particular task, what is the scaling trend for that task, right? MMLU is unlike everything else, where it's like at low duplicates, your model trained on more data is higher, and then the curves cross at some point, and then the dilution happens in like this regime. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I mentioned that like the evaluation metric also makes a difference. So, you know, that changes, for example, whether the curve is smoother or the curve is like more jagged. And we are generally trying to like fit the metric to the, you know, to the data set and to the sort of like, you know, actual risk. So it's like, not clear that like, it's not exactly apples and apples to compare, like, let's say accuracy on a multiple choice test, which is like predicting, you know, like one token, versus like log likelihood on a passage, which is like a much, much longer thing, right? So you can maybe expect that there would be, those wouldn't always like exactly line up. I don't know if this is like a satisfying answer for you, but
no, I get it.
Okay. Awesome. This is a taste of our empirical findings. I also want to just say a couple things about, you know, how I view this or envision this being used as a resource for different types of research. So first of all, like, we're like really committed to making this be like a valuable, like, open source resource, right? And especially for work on memorization, right? It's very important to not only have access to the model weights, but also to have access to the data, so you know, like, what, you know, correlate the behavior with what the model saw during training. In our case, we have, we've open sourced everything, and we also have built a lot of tooling just for like dealing with the data, for querying and editing the data. This is actually now an EMNLP demo track paper itself called TokenSmith. We have all this information, like for all the things we inject, we know not only how many times we injected it, but we know like exactly like when during training we injected each of these things, right? So you could imagine doing a lot of analysis on that. And then combined with the fact that, we do have a lot of intermediate checkpoints as well. Hopefully. And everything's already on Hugging Face. It's not very well organized yet, but it is all, you can actually find all these models already if you go to our Hugging Face.
Robin, I wasn't aware of your TokenSmith project. I wonder, I bet it would be interesting to some of our infrastructure folks, the NDAF folks here.
Okay.
Because, you know, the ability to query over huge amounts of training data, like, would you be able to use your TokenSmith tooling to load in some of the AI2 models training data and allow people to study that? And that is it tied to your
It's data or so data? It's tied a little bit to the pre-training library. So it's anything that's I think follows the Megatron format, which includes like the Eleuther models and several other models. I don't think it includes the EI2 models, however, because I think they have a different code stack. Yeah.
I see. So you could study Pythia this way.
Yeah, you can study Pythia this way. Yeah.
I see. Well, that's better than nothing. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Anyway, maybe afterwards. And we'll have some of the end of people quiz you about.
Yeah. Happy to have those conversations. And then also, honestly, like, I mean, I think probably for this stuff, especially, like, the students are probably better people to quiz. So yeah. We could also put
that'd be really great. Yeah. Really interesting.
Okay, cool. Let's see. Okay, so, but besides this, just like, you know, studying the checkpoints, I think there's also a couple of reasons why Hubble's a great benchmark for, you know, what you might call some sort of like, you know, memorization adjacent tasks. So for example, there's been a lot of interest recently in what's called membership inference attacks for LLM. So, you know, the basic idea of membership inference is you can think of it as like an attacker has access to a model and they want to figure out whether a particular example was present in the model's training set or not, right? Even if the training set is not public. And so you can basically think of this as some sort of binary classification task. They're like members of the training set and then they're non-members. And yeah, the attacker is trying to get high accuracy on this. So a lot of the benchmarks for LLMs, at least, you know, they have to somehow come up with some set of data they know the LLM trained on or like was very likely to have trained on, and other data that the LLM has not trained on. So they often do things like using like temporal shift, right? So things that are before the knowledge cutoff are likely members, things that are after the knowledge cutoff are likely non-members. But this is, as you can imagine, there's a lot of like spurious cues, right? There's probably a lot of ways to figure out when, you know, at least estimate when the article was written, if it was before a certain date or after a certain date. And so there's been a few papers now that are showing that like, yeah, these benchmarks are like pretty flawed, right? You basically don't need access to the model at all. You can sort of just like directly predict whether these are members or non-members. And so the great thing about Hubble here is that, you know, we have these perturbations that we injected and we know that we've randomly assigned them to these two conditions, either like, cause some of them were just assigned to be injected zero times and others got injected more than zero times. And so our MIA benchmark can just be like, yeah, can we distinguish these two? And in addition, we can actually measure like how well does a membership inference attack work as a function of like, how often did we insert the different data points into the training. So we can come up with these plots like this. So here, yeah, we just ran, you know, four standard MIA methods on our largest model. So there's the four different color bars. And so, yeah, for example, we can have one version of the benchmark, which is just saying, can you distinguish things that were, you know, inserted zero times from things that were only inserted once? And here we see that like performance is like more or less random. So you were measuring AUROC. This is just like a typical metric. So close to 50% is random. We're very close to 50% here. And then as you go, you know, as you go higher, right? If you start comparing, for example, can you distinguish between zero duplicates and four duplicates? You start getting a little bit more signal, and this sort of increases to the point where, like, by 64, if you're comparing zero with 64, you get like more or less perfect results. And this is also, yeah, I think like this. I'm again showing the Gutenberg data here, but I think this we also have on like sort of. Couple of the data sets. I think these results, from what I remember, are like pretty consistent, like this pattern here.
What concrete membership inference attacks are you doing?
So basic one is just to like look at the loss on the example. And then we have like min k++, which is this method that was like you basically like look at some like a certain outlier tokens with some outlier loss. There's an improved version, and then I honestly don't remember off the top of my head which one zlib is, but these are the ones. The other thing I think this is Hubble is quite interesting for is unlearning. So you know, so what I'm showing here is like, you know, we ran some unlearning techniques, for example, on this goal of like unlearning some of this like private biography information. One thing that's cool about Hubble is that we have, you know, all this, again, we have this like IID data essentially, some of which was not injected, right? So we can say, for example, we have an unlearned set consisting of some bios we want to forget. We can have this, you know, test set, which is like bios that were unseen, that were injected zero times, but are otherwise IID. And we want to make sure that the model doesn't sort of like collapse on, you know, its ability to predict these, right? There's just some sort of like, you know, prior over like what these sort of bios should look like. We don't want to sort of like eliminate that ability. And of course, we can also just have a keep set of like other bios that were memorized that we would not want the model to forget. Okay, the other kind of, I think, thing that's quite interesting here is that for Hubble, we have this standard model, right? We have this model that has never seen these injected data points. And so we can kind of use that as some sort of like gold star, which says like, okay, when you run unlearning, you should try to be matching the standard model in terms of its performance on the unlearned set, right? So this I think helps like clarify what we might want.
That's cool, Robin. Yeah. Is the standard model and the test model, do they have the same random initialization and things? Are they sort of sister models, or are they unrelated to each other?
Yeah. So they have, okay. I know they have the same data order. We were careful about that. I think they should have the same random initialization. I would need to double check that.
Pretty interesting. Yeah.
I think it might not have been, because I think there were like a original version and the perturbed version, both for zero. I thought there was two dots on the plot, so I think they might be different. In the previous plots where you're showing like the perturbed version, like a bit more before, like the perturbed one also had a zero times point.
Next freeze. Perturbed one also had a, sorry, which plot?
It should be like way more.
Okay.
Like this one, yeah.
Okay,
those ones. Or maybe the next one would be more clearer. Because the solid one is the perturbed one, right?
Yeah.
And then you can see on MMLU, there's like a zero one, and zero one should be the same, right? But
yeah,
but they are different. But they're different points.
So. That's true. Yeah. So they are right. Okay. Yeah. So this is actually a good observation. So Yeah, I think there's something we can discuss. So on some data sets, right, yeah, you do see this. Yeah, for example, on MMLU, there is a small there's a small gap between like this standard and perturbed model, right? The dashed line is a little higher than the solid line. And I think what's happening there is just that like you have, because we injected MMLU examples, there you do get some just like generalization where the model's maybe just like somewhat better at like multiple choice questions in general from being exposed to a multiple choice question. Yeah, so that is, I agree that's an effect that happens on some of these data sets. And it is, that does make it a little hard to disentangle. Like, in some sense, I think maybe what you're getting at is for unlearning application, like, the ideal thing to do, I guess, would be to have like the truly counterfactual model would be trained on all the same data, like except the unlearned set, right? And we have something that's very close, but it's not exactly that, because we have it that's not trained on the unlearned set, but also not trained on several other perturbations. Yeah. So I agree. There's like there's still a bit of a discrepancy. But I think still it's like pretty close, I guess, is what I would say. Yeah. Yeah, and then anyways, yeah, and then so just the results from seeing a few models, basically it's like, just say like, okay, it's actually pretty hard. So on the x-axis here is the unlearning set accuracy. And basically like, you know, ideally you would be able to drag your original perturbed model, which is the red one, you would be able to drag it all the way down in terms of unlearning set accuracy and maintain accuracy on the other stuff. But in practice, that doesn't happen because when you decrease unlearning set accuracy, the other metrics also decrease. So we're not quite getting at this like the gold star that we would like. Okay, so yeah, to wrap up this section, there's like I said, like kind of two big contributions. You know, first just these, you know, these empirical findings that we have, and I think a key takeaway, especially if we're thinking about this like broader audience questions, are like, yeah, we can establish some best practices, for example, related to, you know, dilution, or when you have different types of data in your training, you know, if your goal is to reduce memorization. And then we also, you know, hopefully gotten you interested in using our models as a resource for all sorts of different research. So, let's keep going to the next section. I want to talk about a few different interpretability things we've done. But the main one I'll focus on is this nice story about understanding how LLMs do basic math. Our setting here is pretty simple. So we're going to just fine tune some pre-trained model, like let's say GPT-2XL, to do integer addition. And this is pretty easy for the model. If you just fine tune it a little bit, it can get 100% accuracy. And I guess the other thing I should mention is we're keeping that all the numbers in the problem pretty small, so that they're all just a single token in the tokenizer. So yeah, trying to do study a very simple sort of setting. And it's so simple that you might actually think that maybe the model, just can memorize. It can just throw a big table of answers, right? But actually, what we see is that it doesn't seem to do that. It actually is doing some sort of computation. And so this is how we were able to argue for this. So this is basically a plot where we've done logit lens on the outputs of different MLPs. And so different columns represent different MLPs at different layers. And I'm plotting how much are these basically promoting each possible answer, right? As defined by doing logit lens. So, the correct answer to this problem is 108. And we see that there's some layers that have patterns like this. So this layer, layer 33, it seems like it's just every other number is darker, right? And so basically what this is saying is that it's just promoting all of the even numbers, this other layer here, you can see that there's sort of a dark pattern roughly every 10, right? There's on, 88 and 78, it's darker than the rest. And so this is basically promoting all the numbers that are 8 mod 10, right? So when we looked at this, we said it seems actually there's some just modular arithmetic that is happening, right? The model is correct in knowing that the answer should be 8 mod 10. And this layer seems to be focusing on that and not necessarily, only promoting the exact correct answer. And then there are some other layers which seem they're also not very selective, but what they're promoting is a bunch of numbers that are sort of close to the right answer, right? So you can see, 108 is dark here, but then also neighboring numbers are also darker than the rest, right? So this is sort of, in some sense, you could say it's approximating the answer. It knows that the answer is roughly 108. So when we saw these plots, we were that's interesting. We have something, some sort of periodic structure here, right? In things like this. And so what do you do when you see periodic structure? Of course, you want to, I think loads, you want to take the Fourier transform and understand understand the, decompose this into some, periodic components. So, when we take the Fourier transform of each column, right, so you just think of each column in the previous slide as just some time varying signal, we can decompose that and find that, you get these very interesting spikes, what we call these outlier frequencies. And in particular, at the right end of these plots, which is sort of the high frequency, you have these very sparse spikes, right? So this layer, this is layer 33 from before. So the one that was promoting all the even numbers. So this one has a very high spike at a period of 2, which makes sense, right? But there's also spikes at 5 and 10, for example, right? So there's also some sort of there's some part of it that's also periodic with a period of 5. And then we can see similar things for attention, right? We also get these sort of spikes, and they all tend to be at these kind of nice numbers, right? Things 2, 5, and 10. I can talk more about why we think that is, but basically it has a lot to do with the fact that we use base 10 as in our lives. So we see that basically there are these key outlier frequencies that are really seem to be playing a key role. And so what do we think is going on here? What we think is happening is that the model is basically in parallel doing computation at these different frequencies, right? So there's some low frequency computation. And so this is represented, for example, by this this orange line, right? So if you extract just one of the low frequency things from the Fourier transform, you see that the model has some component that's basically trying to peek roughly at the right answer, right? So this is like the approximation part. And then there are the high frequency parts, which are, you know, these high frequency sine waves that are trying to classify, like let's say the answer mod 2 or mod 5, right? And these are also trying to peek, have a peek at the correct answer. But of course, they also have, you know, many other peaks at things that are congruent mod 2 or mod 5. And if you just sum all of these waves together, what you get is, you know, this complicated shape that will actually, you know, peak at the right place, right? So this is sort of our explanation for like, how the model ultimately arrives at the right answer. Okay, so so this, all this study so far is just purely observational. So, you know, the next thing we wanted to do is we said like, you know, can we actually establish some sort of, you know, causal relationship here? So the idea was that, you know, we can again start with this Fourier transform. And so what if we only project out, let's say, the low frequency component, or high frequency components. We project out the high frequency components. We only keep the low frequency components. We can see how that alters the final prediction of the model. And then conversely, we can do the reverse, right? We can say, you know, let's filter out the low frequency components and only retain the high frequency components and see how that affects the model's prediction. Basically, like, you actually get very predictable effects when you do these things. Some lag. What's going on? Okay, So first of all, if we're filtering out the low frequency information, it turns out to be sufficient to just do this to the MLPs. And it actually has a quite large effect on the predictions. So if you filter out the low frequency stuff, the model suddenly starts making a lot of errors that are like off by 10 or off by 50 or off by 100. So what this means is that like the model's still correct mod 10, but it's sort of lost the ability to just know approximately how big the answer is, right? And so this is like a sign that, you know, specifically the MLPs in this low frequency dimensions are trying to like approximate the right answer. And correspondingly, we can filter the high frequency components. And here it turns out it's sufficient to only do this at the attention layers. And you can cause the model to make a lot of like off by 1 or off by 2 errors. This is just the reverse, right? We're still approximately correct, but now we have lost the ability to be correct like mod 10 or like even mod 5. So this high frequency part in the attention layers is what's doing this sort of like classification mod n. Finally, we had, we were interested in like sort of whether this is something that's just like fundamental to transformers or this is actually related to pre-training. And I think we had like all the results point to the fact that pre-training is actually like kind of crucial for this particular mechanism. So first of all, we can see that the embeddings at like the pre-trained token level, like the token embeddings of the integers already contain these sort of like Fourier frequencies. So basically, we just like look at each dimension of the token embeddings, they also tend to have these sort of periodic patterns with the exact same, you know, nice numbers as periods, right? 10 and 5 and 2. And then moreover, we can do some experiments to actually show that it's the pre-trained token embeddings that really matter. So in this plot, so first let's focus on this black line. So the black line shows what happens if we take an identical transformer architecture, like a GPT-2 architecture, but we randomly initialize it and then train it to just do addition. So in that experiment, basically like it optimizes very slowly and it never reaches 100% accuracy, right? So in this plot, it only gets to maybe like 50. If we train it for a lot longer, it can get to like maybe 94, but it still doesn't fully solve the task. And if you do the same sort of analysis we did before, we basically don't see any of the high frequency components, right? It makes a lot of off by one errors because it's trying to do everything with the like approximation mechanism. It doesn't learn it. It doesn't figure out that like doing some sort of like modular addition is a good idea to get the precise answer. This red line shows like if we only kind of use the pre-trained token embeddings and the rest of the transformer can still be randomly initialized, which I think is like it's very surprising, right? So all we do is change, put back the token embeddings. It turns out this is enough to basically like rescue the performance of this model. It in fact like converges quite quickly to being able to get 100% accuracy. Yeah, so basically these token embeddings turn out to be super critical And if you have the right features, the transformer is sort of already set up to learn this algorithm we described. Okay, so the sort of like high level takeaway here is like, you know, and I think why I like this as a story so much is that, you know, it is true that the way the LLM is doing this addition task, it's not very human-like, right? None of us learn to do like this particular way of adding numbers together in grade school. But even though it's not human-like, it actually is something that we can still make sense of, and we can understand like why it should work, right? So that's like a very kind of like, you know, optimistic tale, right? Like, I don't think we should necessarily expect LLMs to do everything in the same way that humans do, but hopefully we can still make sense of whatever they are doing, right? And also, yeah, just to, you know, the sort of pre-training is sort of very key for this to emerge. And so we're doing some other work now and trying to understand, for example, like what sort of data is sufficient to get you these sorts of Fourier features when you do pre-training. So yeah, happy to talk more about that offline. I'll do one slide on some sort of follow-up work we've done, which is basically, you know, taking this, you know, this idea that a lot of people are interested in is like, how can we take these interpretability results and like make them actionable, right? So in our case, so we have this understanding of like, okay, how do transformers just sort of naturally learn how to do arithmetic, at least after they're pre-trained? And so if we actually now change our goal to be like, can we make them better at doing arithmetic? There's actually a natural idea, which is that we can take these, you know, at the token level, we know that those pre-trained token embeddings were super important, right? So instead of relying on the pre-trained embeddings, we could also just hard code these, you know, Fourier features into the representations. And, you know, the reason you might expect this to be better is that, you know, the features that were learned through pre-training, right, they probably have some noise associated with them, right? There's like, you know, because they have to be learned through GD, there's probably like some numbers that were like seen less frequently whose features are probably like not perfect, right? But we could just like hard code them with some like sines and cosines. And it turns out that this helps a transformer, at least if you train a transformer from scratch, this enables you to be like very sample efficient at learning, you know, not only addition, but also like subtraction and multiplication. So this plot just, you know, I'm showing doing 6-digit addition. And it turns out that for our method is this red line. As long as you give it more than maybe like, you know, 3,000 data points or something, it can get like very close to 100% accuracy on doing 6-digit addition. And then if you give it maybe one order of magnitude more data, it actually gets like exactly 100%. So the stars mean it gets like exactly 100% on like a very large test set, right? So it's actually like perfect at the task. This is much better than if you, for example, start with like a digit-wise tokenization, or you do like subword tokenization. These are both much worse. And this is even, you know, in some regimes better than fine-tuning a much larger language model that was pre-trained, right? So if you take like this Llama 3 model, it obviously starts at a higher place just because like even if you have zero training data, it has like some knowledge of addition already. But you know, if you fine-tune it, it grows sort of more slowly than our approach. And there's like this regime where like this fine-tuned model is like still making a lot of errors. But our method with the same amount of data and again a randomly initialized model is actually being like perfect. Okay, and then yeah, so I think the other reason that I think this is interesting is that through this scheme we can basically take any number and kind of turn it into a single token representation. So this is also nice because it avoids some issues with tokenization, and it's also just more efficient because you have fewer tokens. And so we're currently trying to figure out like if this is actually practical to incorporate into like an actual LLM pre-training. I think there's a lot of hurdles there. For example, the fact that like oftentimes you see numbers in the data and they're not actually numbers, they're like, you know, zip codes or something. And so I think we still have there's things to figure out to make this more practical, but I think this is like a definitely like kind of an interesting proof of concept here for these randomly initialized models. Cool, yeah. So any questions on this section about these like sort of math abilities?
I had a question, but you sort of already answered that. So you learned some elements of mechanism going on inside the model when it is doing this 10 base additions.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say without any training, can you take some of these insights back to GPT-2 Excel to make it better at training? make it better prediction.
Yeah. So that would be sort of like, it's similar to this, but I guess you actually want to modify the model that's already pre-trained, right?
Yeah, during like inference time intervention, like while it is doing some kind of addition, you will basically boost some of the signals, and does it like suddenly make it better?
Actually, this is a... Right. So it's a good question. So in terms... Okay, so first, I guess in terms of inference... I guess we hadn't even thought about doing it at inference, or maybe we thought about it. We didn't really try doing it at inference time. We tried doing it at like a continual pre-training stage to try to like basically swap out the original number representations for like something that's like we call these phone for Fourier number encoding. So to swap those out for like those like phone representations. That turned out to be hard to get that to work because there's just some like distribution shift with the pre-trained model, right? It's just like not used to seeing these embeddings. And so like you get an initial loss in performance, and you can do continual pre-training to try to like recover back to the original point, but it doesn't actually seem to get better. So we were thinking that like either we just need like a different way of doing it, or we need to pre-train from scratch. The other sort of issue that you start running into is that like if you have numbers that are like not that small, then the original model expects them to be tokenized into multiple tokens, right?
The answer itself
or even like the input numbers. Okay. Yeah. And so even though like this method in theory can like you can encode any number into a single token, but it's like not what the model is like prepared to do. So yeah.
So I think this is very, very cool, that especially the proof of concept here. But in terms of like actually porting it back in, I mean, isn't the answer just use tools? Like we have calculators, no? we can just train them to call. If the goal is to actually improve mathematical operations, presumably. But I mean,
I think it's a point well taken, and I think I myself am like I go back and forth on this. Like yes, it is definitely true that you can't. You definitely can't have tools. I guess the two things I would say is that like number one, I think this is just to some extent, I think I view this as like an interesting sort of proof of concept, like not even proof of concept, but like it's a good test bed. I think it's for understanding some more general questions about like what sort of features these models learn and can we can we improve models this way, right? So totally. Hopefully it's going to be a stepping stone to something that's harder to have tools for. The other thing is that I think there's like, I guess adding any sort of like tooling harness does increase complexity, right? So it's like nice, like for at least something that's like so simple, like as like addition, like it'd be nice if we like did not have to increase complexity in order to get...
Well, not if you have to start mucking around with tokenization and stuff, but maybe, yeah, right?
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of like once the model is trained, then at inference time, you don't have to
think. In this case. I guess I was just talking more about like, can we,
Right. So if you're doing stuff at inference time, then yes, that also increases your complexity. Yes.
So obviously, this is not how we do math, but did you see any relationship between, maybe not for addition, but for other operations, between the way the model is performing these operations implicitly and how, it would verbally explain that operation on, let's say, a tutoring task?
That's interesting. Yeah.
How would I multiply these two numbers? Mm-hmm. Is that influenced at all by what's happening when it is multiplying numbers?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I haven't thought about that. I think that would be super interesting to look into. Presumably the model has also seen like explanations that are tailored to humans, right? So it should still be able to mimic those explanations. But what the relationship is between that and like this stuff. Yeah, definitely interesting.
Well, one thing I find really interesting about this is it sort of seems to be the case that it hasn't memorized a table, right? Mm-hmm. Like it hasn't memorized an addition or multiplication table. It's almost as if it's developed a sort of... a different representation of math. Maybe it's not the way we teach addition algorithms in school, but it might actually have some, I don't know, I'm almost feeling like people who are like very intuitively good at arithmetic might actually have something almost approaching the style of addition.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I think there's like, yeah, I think I was giving this talk somewhere else, and then people were saying that, oh, so this is a sign that the models have some sort of like number sense, right? Mm-hmm. Some sort of like intuitive grasp of these numbers. Yeah, which I think, I buy that. Yeah, so yeah.
Do you happen to try out like more general math questions besides?
So yeah, like we weren't able, so this, because the transformer part itself is trained from scratch, like it's not ready to do something like GSM8K. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we tried to do that with our like continual pre-training to get it like improvements in GSM8K, but we have not seen them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're still trying. Yeah. Oh yeah, there's a question up there. Yeah.
I have a question.
There's a question from the hallway that we're taking.
Final answer, but I also saw some other periodic activations that were being made. Mm-hmm. Is it possible, like, if there's some that like alter the time, this one that might be? Because one was like, I saw that one was not so confident on final answer.
Yeah. So you're saying, is there an attack that
changes time distributing the end frame since auto does not take a full solution?
Yeah. I guess it depends on what the attacker is allowed to do. Like, yeah, certainly. I mean, as we showed, like, because we do all these like interventions on the hidden state. Yeah, if you know where to intervene on the hidden state, yeah, you can definitely change the prediction. Yeah. Yeah.
All the different periodic.
Right. Yeah. But I guess it depends on like if. I guess the question is whether that's a realistic thing for the attacker to be able to do. It seems like if they have access to the internal state, they can do all sorts of things. The Zoom question.
So I'm just curious whether do you think the same mechanisms are at play if we ask the model to do addition, but you know, we present the problem, right? You know, Susan had two apples, and then John came and gave her like three more apples. How many apples does Susan have now? Will the model also utilize the same kinds of mechanisms to do kind of addition in this setting where it has to figure out if addition is at play, or is this just like when it's explicitly told to some distant number?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I would expect it to be the same, but yeah, we didn't actually measure that, so that's, yeah. I think that would probably be a good like good sort of like robustness check on these results to test it. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, I'm not sure if you mentioned this before, but the pre-trained model before you fine-tuned it, mm-hmm. was it like more approximate, or like how bad was it before fine-tuning? And do you have a sense of like fine-tuning teaches it the exact mechanism, like the high frequency stuff, or like it was kind of just really bad at the beginning and then it learned both of them?
It's been a while. I think this is in the paper, but I guess I have two answers to that. So I think GPT-2 was like not terrible at addition, but it's just like not that good of a model, right? So I think, and we wanted to and it was like a pretty small amount of fine-tuning that could make it get 100%, so we focused on that. I guess we could look at like what the like Fourier patterns look like before as well. The other experiments we did have is we had some other larger open weight models that we just did with in context learning that actually were like good at arithmetic, and then we do see the very same like similar like features in the models. Those models like generally, they were not like 100% accurate, but they were like maybe like, I don't know, 80-90% accurate. Yeah, for the same mechanism. Okay. Awesome. I'm just checking the time. I think Kiana said that we could go until 11:30, right? Yeah, okay. We'll probably do that. I've also thrown in a couple extra slides Yeah, I want to just like briefly mention this like related work that I also just think is would be fun, especially for this audience. some other interpretability stuff that came out of this collaboration with Jonathan Gratch, who's a professor at USU, does a lot of like emotion related emotion and like, you know, like computing system sort of research. So what I learned from like basically one of his students took my class, and what I learned from them is that there's this thing called appraisal theory in like the like, you know, psychology like of emotion literature. So appraisal theory basically says or hypothesizes that like as people, we reason about emotions through these things called appraisals. So basically the different sort of like, you know, like attributes about a circumstance, right? So if someone says, oh, this exam was hard and I feel like I couldn't have done better even if I studied more. So this is, you know, there's an appraisal here that like they did not think that they had any agency in affecting the outcome, right? And so that might lead them to feel sad. Whereas if someone says, oh, this exam was hard and, you know, I wish I had studied more because I could have done better, then they feel like they did have agency. They had some control, but they just like chose the wrong thing. And then this might cause them to feel like guilty instead of sad, right? So the idea is that like these appraisals are actually like how we actually like reason and like, you know, experience emotions. So we LLMs, we basically took LLMs and, you know, we asked them to do this task of like, you know, here's a story. What emotion is this person likely to experience? And we could basically just like probe it both for, you know, basically like where it's predicting these emotions and also where or if it is representing these appraisals. And we do find that like, yeah, we can probe both of these, both the emotions and appraisals from some intermediate layers. And I think the especially cool part is that we also established there's some sort of like causal relationship here, which you can do with steering. So basically what this plot is showing is that in the, we have some like basically base condition, we just have some data set that has, you know, a lot of different emotions. So the model predicts some sort of like broad distribution of emotions. So in this next panel, we can basically steer on these, you know, we have a probe for this like pleasantness, which is one of these appraisal dimensions. And we can steer it. So in this case, we can steer it towards the direction of like low pleasantness. And what happens when we do that is that the final prediction from the model starts being dominated by things like anger or fear or sadness, right? All things that, you know, are associated with unpleasant situations. And then we can even steer multiple things at the same time. So here we can steer both pleasantness to go down, and we steer this appraisal of like other people's agency, basically. So like, was this a result of what someone else did, right? And so if we increase the steering on others' agency, then this just causes the model to like basically always predict anger, right? So it's like, yeah, if something was unpleasant and it was because of someone else, then you're going to feel angry. I think it's very cool that basically like we can establish these sort of like causal patterns inside the LLM that actually like recapitulate this like existing theory.
They disagree. Are there any points of disagreement between LLMs and humans?
So I think, I have to look at the full results. I think this one was maybe like the cleanest one where it does line up. I think it doesn't always perfectly line up. I feel like with those, it's always like a little hard to tell, like if how much of it is just like steering is a bit out of distribution, right? And you get a little noisy. But I think I would say in general, the patterns, do agree with like what you would expect, but maybe not 100%. Yes.
I have a question about the causal model. How can you be sure that you are steering the appraisal and not the emotion?
This is a good question. I need to remember the paper, because I remember having conversations about this. If I remember correctly, we did. Honestly, like if we chat offline, I can refresh myself on the details, because I remember we tried to do some stuff where we tried to like separate out the vectors, right? So basically, because we get a bunch of probe directions for the appraisal directions and also for the motion directions, and I think we did try to do some sort of correction that like disentangles them, but it's definitely a concern. Maybe we can talk more offline too. Yes. Okay, cool. I'll maybe briefly do this other one on in-context learning, because I think it's fun and people are asking. So we had this study about you know, in context learning and the I think everyone knows about in context learning. You get some demonstrations in the prompt, you get a test example, you have to predict the answer on the new test example. And basically there have been a bunch of these works that hypothesize that like what's happening inside the model is that it's able to do some sort of like gradient descent like thing, right? You can imagine that, like, you know, yeah, this is like obviously like your like first go-to tool in machine learning, right? We have some data set, we need to make a prediction. What should we do? We should like run gradient descent on some loss, right? And so there's this work, for example, showing that like, yes, we can construct a transformer to implement, like, you know, so that like one layer of the transformer can implement one layer of gradient descent, right? And so this is, you know, some evidence for this hypothesis. But yeah, basically we wanted to look at this and ask like, okay, is it really doing gradient descent? You know, why wouldn't it learn? Why wouldn't it learn something else, right? And what we found is actually that transformers are doing something that actually is like more sophisticated or like more efficient than gradient descent. So here's how we were able to do this. So we're training a transformer to do one particular task of what people call like in-context linear regression. So it's just kind of like a nice test bed for in-context learning. And we can probe this transformer at each layer to figure out like what is its prediction at the current layer. So that gets us, yeah, that gets us one set of predictions. We can compare that with like, what if we just like ran gradient descent on the linear regression problem for like different numbers of iterations, right? So that would also yield some set of predictions. And then we can try to kind of match, right? So like basically, where do the errors of the transformer at, you know, layer 6 best align with in terms of like how many gradient steps you've done? And so the yellow squares are like sort of saying like, this is the best match for each transformer layer. And what we see is that, first of all, like if you get towards like the last few layers of this model, the sort of progress you've made is equivalent to doing like 1,000 steps of gradient descent. So this actually suggests to you that like already suggests that like, you know, maybe, you know, gradient descent is sort of too weak to explain what's going on here. And moreover, you see this like, you know, mismatch in convergence rate. So there's basically like many layers of the transformer where it seems like almost nothing is happening. And then there's like a couple layers that seem to be making progress equivalent to like multiple hundreds of steps of gradient descent, right? So this means like it doesn't really, this hypothesis that they're doing gradient descent doesn't really seem to be a very good fit. On the other hand, we can do the exact same plot, but we can instead use iterates of a different optimization algorithm. So this is this like iterative Newton-Schultz algorithm. It's basically trying to approximate the inverse of this like X transpose X matrix. This is what you need to do to solve linear regression. And if you compare with iterates of that, you see this really nice linear trend, right? So across like many layers of this model, basically like every time you go one transformer layer forward, you've basically made the same progress as doing like three of these Newton steps. And so like this we take as evidence that like this is what the transformer doing is at least like much closer to this algorithm, which is exponentially faster than the gradient descent algorithm. Question.
Sorry. Yeah. So trying to understand how to read this, the yellow is what the transformer's correlation is with the correct answer, or
The yellow is like we take the residuals from the transformer. And we say like which residuals does it best match out of all the different possible like numbers of gradient descent steps? Yeah. Cool. Cool. Yeah. So that's sort of the main results I wanted to say. Like one additional interesting point from this paper is that this is quite architecture dependent. And so basically, what this plot is just saying is that if you probe different layers of the transformer, you actually do get different curves. You know, like basically the darker line here means it shows like the error of the last layer, which is much better than the error of early layers. But on the far right is the same plot if you train a deep LSTM. And the LSTM actually doesn't seem to improve over layers at all. So we think that what the LSTM is doing is actually much more like some sort of like online gradient descent algorithm, right? It's just doing something completely different from the transformer. So yeah, maybe high level takeaways here You know, transformers don't necessarily implement, you know, the like most obvious algorithm. And in fact, like, at least in this case, they've actually learned to implement something that is like exponentially faster. And this is, again, quite architecture dependent. And so where this work is going is that we have, you know, a similar project that we're trying to submit to iClear about this, you know, about this more general question of like, when do transformers actually learn these like efficient algorithms? And so for like graph connectivity, there's another like interesting story about how like they're, we train transformers to do graph connectivity. Similarly, they're like different algorithms they could learn and also different heuristics they could latch onto. Sometimes TLDR is like, depending on the data, actually, sometimes it will learn a really nice algorithm. And other times it will like learn to latch onto heuristics. And we have some like interesting analysis of exactly when that happens. Okay, maybe I'll just skip this one. And then I wanna get to this last one. Okay, we talked about this last one briefly. This is, yeah, shifting gears a lot. But going back to this overall idea of like, you know, we wanna understand these models in a broad sense. And in addition to looking at the internals, well, we should also just be doing a lot of, you know, benchmarking for tasks where they're actually being used. And so in this project, we collaborated with Rayshan, who's a CS professor who does a lot of like AI and health stuff, and several folks from the USC Keck School of Medicine. So Roman, Jade, and Mazen are all oncology fellows, and George is an oncology professor. And so we all work together on trying to understand, you know, what happens when patients with cancer or their family members are asking cancer-related, you know, like advice questions to chatbots. Okay, so, you know, many of you maybe recognize this already, but yeah, like people are asking LLMs for medical advice quite frequently now. So this study says it's like maybe 1 in 6 and even higher for younger people, and this is maybe like a year old, so I think it's probably gone up since then. So in this context, like, you know, we have to ask questions like, what is the quality of this advice that LLMs are giving? And, you know, what harms might be arising because of this? So our approach to this is like, so first what we wanted to do is we wanted to just like find some sort of data that could be representative of like, what are the sorts of questions people might be asking, right? Without actually access to like the, you know, LLM logs or something. We found this website, which is website called Cancer Care. So they basically get questions from either patients or their family members. You can see here, it's kind of maybe like a short paragraph that describes their condition. You know, again, written in the, you know, not written by a medical professional, it's written by the patients. This website provides answers that are written by clinical social workers. So we took, you know, a sample of these questions, and we also just like fed them directly to, you know, 3 standard language models. And our 3 oncology fellows basically sort of rated, you know, without knowing which answers came from which one, they sort of rated at the paragraph level different sort of you know, aspects of basically like, yeah, does this answer provide, you know, any sort of like wrong information? Is it misleading? Is it like recommending something that's unrealistic and so forth? Overall, in this pilot study, we found that the LLMs actually score quite well. And, you know, there are actually cases where the physicians kind of prefer the LLM answer to the social worker's answer, which may be indicative of like they have different training between the medical doctors and the social workers. But what we also found when we were just like, you know, kind of interviewing the oncologists and kind of going over their annotations is that they found some cases that are kind of like this. So in this case, there's, you know, someone says, oh, you know, my mom was diagnosed with lymphoma. And they heard from their companions that because it's in such an advanced stage, you know, like you can't treat this disease, basically. And the language model answer is to just say like, oh, okay, that means that you're going to be focusing on, you know, palliative care, or basically means like you're not directly treating, but managing the symptoms. It says a lot of things, you know, that might be reasonable for in terms of palliative care. But like, you know, what the doctors wanted to point out here is that like this assumption is not necessarily true, right? They you know, especially because this is like something that was not said by this person's doctor, but just by like her friends, right? This might not be a good assumption for her situation, but the model just sort of goes along with it, right? It's they're like, yeah, okay, we'll just like take this as given. And so we felt like this seems like an instance of this issue of like models like to just agree with what we say they don't like to push back against it, and they just, they try to be, you know, helpful to answer the questions. But yeah, like, so what we wanted to do now is, like, we basically said, like, okay, can we come up with some sort of, like, larger data set? Because this was just, like, a few examples we found in this pilot study. Can we come up with, like, a large data set that really tests the specific challenge of, like, you know, patients have, you know, misconceptions, you know, it's, I guess it's, you know, very natural that they should have them because, you know, it's a, you know, complex disease. But, you know, how can we test whether LLMs can, like, push back on misconceptions when it's appropriate to do so? Okay, so we basically created this pipeline, and we actually used LLMs quite heavily in this pipeline, and then we were able to get oncologists to verify. So basically how this works is that we started by, like, just, like, finding these, like, common, you know, misconceptions about cancer from the web. Turns out there are many websites that have these for, you know, for patients' references. We can prompt an LLM to generate a question that presupposes this somehow. And then basically we have some other steps that are basically trying to make sure these questions are, like, somewhat challenging. So it turns out if you just, like, maybe directly state something that is a known misconception, the LLM is able to sort of recognize it. But so we have this loop where we basically, like, you know, get an initial LLM answer. We can check if it answers, if it does in fact, like, challenge its presupposition. And we use that to sort of alter the way we prompt the model, right? So we're gonna try to prompt the model in future iterations to generate things that are more, are like the questions that do, like, have fooled the, or have caused the LLM in the past to, like, ignore the presupposition, right? So this is our way of, like, trying to get a somewhat challenging data set. And then finally, you know, we, like, go back to our physicians and they kind of validate that, you know, in all these questions, yes, there is indeed some sort of misconception that's present. And this is something that is, like, they would want the LLM to sort of push back on, right? And not just sort of ignore. Okay. And then the in terms of the results, you know, as we expected, the LLMs are not very good at correcting these sorts of misconceptions. So we have this, you know, LLM as judge setup where basically you get a score of 1 if you actually, you know, like, address this misconception, a score of 0 if you sort of, like, you know, you mention it at some point, but it doesn't really, like, push back on it. And then there's a score of -1, which just means, like, you didn't even, like, say anything about this assumption. And yeah, like, the all these models that we tested, at least, correct this misconception, like, less than 30% of the time at most. And many of them are actually, like, quite a bit lower than that even. Yeah, one other, you know, final experiment that we had that we're just adding now is that, you know, one thing you might ask is, like, okay, could you prompt engineer the model to just, like, look for these assumptions and push back on it? And, like, yes, you can do this, but it does come with a cost that you tend to get worse accuracy on other tasks. So the way we set this up is we have some, we use JEPA, which is just this, like, kind of, you know, like, automatic prompt optimization tool. We can run JEPA one time on some suite of just, like, sort of standard, you know, like, medical QA benchmarks. We get some accuracies on that. Then we can run JEPA again on a combination of those benchmarks and our data set. And then basically we see that, like, performance on our data set goes up a lot, but performance on everything else kind of degrades a little bit. So there's a trade-off here within the model. This is, like, you know, again, I'm very happy to get feedback here. Like, I think this is this project came out of, you know, me and our group, you know, kind of recognizing that, you know, with the current state of the world, I think we really should be kind of going outside of our, you know, familiar NLP territory in order to evaluate these LLMs. You know, I felt like we learned a lot through doing this sort of deep dive on what, you know, what you might say in some sense is, like, kind of a narrow scope, but I think we just learned a lot by really trying to understand what's happening in that domain. And I'll mention, like, you know, our group is, we're trying to collaborate with a lot of different folks who are outside of the AI world. You know, we've collaborated with lawyers, collaborating with folks in, like, programming languages, for example, on, like, you know, because all these different folks want to understand, like, what sort of implications do these LLMs have for work in my field, right? And then finally, yeah, like, LLMs were actually quite useful for us also because, you know, we can use them to create this data set. Yeah, so let me just end on some sort of other conclusions, right? I really think that we just have like such an important responsibility for our field of AI research, right? To scientifically understand these models as they're being sort of like, you know, widely deployed now and that everyone's using them. And we should be thinking about, you know, what impact can we have both for our community and for, you know, well beyond that, right? So in terms of memorization, right, there's lots of, you know, besides the model developers, right, this you know, provides insights for things for policymakers or courts. You know, we've written articles again about like copyright, how might courts decide these sort of copyright related issues, you know, implications for anyone who is publishing articles online and is concerned about these sorts of things and so forth. I think in terms of understanding these mechanisms, there's sort of, yeah, actionability within the AI community, right? Which is like, how can we like, you know, make the LLMs more reliable? But I also hope like longer term, like, you know, as we understand the internals, this also helps us as computer scientists better like communicate what's going on with them to the rest of the world. And of course, you know, in terms of benchmarking, right? Like not only researchers, but also the public needs to know a lot about, you know, like what are the potential, you know, things they should be cautious about, you know, what are the safer situations to use these models and so forth. So yeah, I'll end there. And yeah, thank you all very much. Question back?
Just a question about the misconceptions. Did you think when the LLMs did recognize the misconceptions and correct the users, was it when the LLMs themselves were aware of the misconception and believed otherwise? And vice versa, do you think they don't correct misconceptions because they are biased towards them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess we should run that as a control. There's other projects we've done in the group suggest to me that it's not a matter of knowledge. Like, so we basically have some other projects where like the LLM will generate some wrong answers and like not realize that their own answers are wrong. But then if you ask them in like a separate interaction, like, is this fact true? Then they'll say like, no, it's not true, right? So I think it seems like in general, there is like somewhat of a disconnect between like, you know, what, you know, like, yeah, the sort of, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is like, it's a very human concept to talk about like what the LLMs know or not know, but it seems like for the models, like it's very like contextual. Like in some situations they'll behave as if they know something. And so clearly the knowledge is somewhere there, but then in other situations they'll just behave as if they don't know it. So, yes.
So I would like to slightly better understand the Fourier method.
Oh yeah.
Would it be possible for you to go back to that slide?
Sure. Is there a particular slide you want?
No, I don't remember the specific slide, but
okay. Or yeah, what was your question, maybe?
Yeah. So you apply the Fourier transform. So I was not super clear about the connection between the logit length and the Fourier transform.
Oh, I see. Okay, so the connection is that we first do logit lens. Yeah, so like here. So for example, let's do this. Yeah, so for example, like we can take this column, right? So this is just like the output of one MLP, and then we project it into the vocabulary space through logit lens. And, you know, we can just take like this column. You know, there's like a number for like how much does it promote 68? There's another number for how much does it promote 69 and so forth, right? So we can just take that as a big, view that as like one just like signal, like time varying signal, and then convert that to just Fourier transform that like sequence of numbers. Yeah,
and
that's how we
get
the spot.
All the numbers in the vocabulary, or is it a small set of numbers?
In these experiments, the way the GPT-2 tokenizer works is that all integers between 1 and 520 are a single token. So, and then after that, you start getting multiple tokens. So we do everything between 1 and 520.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you see these kinds of patterns where there is high spikes at certain Fourier components.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So given a specific number, can you figure out which components are going to have the spikes?
Given a number, can you figure out which components will have the spikes?
Or
Yeah.
So you have this Laurent lens column.
Yeah.
You apply the Fourier transform.
Yeah.
And you get this spikes at certain
frequencies.
Frequencies. So that represent those frequencies are the ones which are more promoted by the MLP neurons. Are more frequently promoted by the MLP neurons.
Right. Yeah. Or like the pattern of promotion of the MLP neurons has a large periodic component with like that frequency.
Yeah, periodic.
Yeah, like basically the fact that the highest spike here is at a period of two corresponds to the fact that this is promoting every other number.
Okay. One more question. So I think you mentioned the low frequency one was promoting the correct answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the high frequency was sort of like calibrating it.
Calibrating. I guess what I'd say that low frequency one is sort of approximately predicting the correct answer. But it has some error. And here, for example, like this low frequency one is peaking at like, I don't know, maybe 112 or something. So it's not exactly getting the correct answer just by itself.
Okay, but it is pretty close. And then the high frequency ones are sort of like pushing it closer and closer to the correct answer.
I guess I think another way to think about it is like the high frequency ones can help it rule out other numbers, right? It's like, oh, I know the answer is like close to 112. But it also has to be 8 mod 10, and therefore, like, I'm going to choose 108. Yeah.
I see. Okay. Thanks.
I actually have a question, related question related to the intervention. Okay. You mentioned, say, you want to filter out low frequency and high frequency components. Mm-hmm. I can get it when you just filter out, like, the logic lens readout, but don't know, like, how it translates to the feature space where you're trading.
So basically, it's like, I guess the way it works is that right, so the logit lens projection is just like a linear mapping, right?
Yeah.
And then from that space, the Fourier transform is another linear mapping. And so we can just have, you can think of it as we're doing like a constrained optimization problem. We're saying that like a particular linear projection of the hidden state has to like be zero.
I see what you mean.
And then subject to that, I'm going to find the closest hidden state in like let's say Euclidean distance.
See, something like the null space of the transform of the logit lens.
Yeah.
Where the null space. Where it actually correspond to, like reducing the frequency space of the logit lens readout.
Right.
Okay, I get it. Makes sense.
One more one in the similar realm. Have you thought of any other task where this kind of Fourier analysis would be helpful? Or are you gonna see this kind of pattern?
Yeah, this is a great question. This is like one thing that we've been struggling with for a while, like, because it's, yeah, this is very nice for numbers, but like, how do you generalize this beyond numbers? So what I'll say is that like, so this mechanism, like right here, like this, like these different waves, I would say that this is very reminiscent of some other work that says like, you know, for example, for knowledge recall, you might like sum up a bunch of different constraints, right? There's a paper called like summing up the facts, right? Like, for example, like, and so there's, it feels like there's something similar to this. It's like, yeah. And other situations where like, you have to take multiple constraints and find something that satisfies all of them. So I think for that, there seem to be analogs. We're not so sure about other analogs for Fourier stuff specifically. Unless you go to like there's like other mathematical objects where you could have that. But like besides that, yeah, I think we've been brainstorming for a little while. Yeah. If any of you have ideas,
thing that came to my mind as well. But if you can show it empirically, that would be great.
Yeah. But I guess knowledge is different because like you don't necessarily have like, it's not like you have like a bunch of things on a number line.
I wasn't fully tracking all the details. A question: are the low frequency appeared in the lower levels?
Not necessarily. No. They're all sort of they're just all in different dimensions of the hidden states.
So, Raman, how long are you with us today? Are you going to be able to be here for the afternoon?
Yeah, I'll be here for the whole day. Yeah. So I think there was a meeting schedule that circulated.
That's right. Yeah. So there's a spreadsheet around, right? And is it already all full, David?
I haven't checked.
Okay, yes. Yeah. So if So, but David is keeping a spreadsheet. So if anybody wants to grab a little bit of Robin's time, there's one slot left. So if there's more than one student, you might want to team up and speak as a group.
Yeah. So if you're free after 5, I'm happy to stay past 5.
Thank you, Robin. I really appreciate it. Yeah. And thanks for the great talk.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Okay.